I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and now it's New Hampshire's turn. The presidential candidates are blanketing the state the day before the first-in-the-country primary, and just 4 days after the Iowa caucuses, the shortest turnaround ever. A new Reuters poll out today shows Democratic Senator Barack Obama continuing to bounce from his first-place showing in Iowa. Obama now comes in at 39% compared to Hillary Clinton's 29% and John Edwards with 19%. On the Republican side, Senator John McCain has a 5-point lead over Mitt Romney, 34% to 29%. Mike Huckabee and Rudy Giuliani hover around 10% in New Hampshire. Polls also show a huge number, nearly 50% of undecided voters, and our own Unscientific poll backs that up, as you'll hear. But first, Peter Walston of the Los Angeles Times joins us from Manchester, New Hampshire. Peter, what's jumping out at you today?
Well, it seems that Hillary Clinton has really shifted gears. It seems that maybe they've learned a lesson from what happened in Iowa and what the polls are saying now, and she seems to be much more relaxed on the campaign trail. She's taking questions from reporters, which is almost unheard of. At least it was in Iowa when everything was so controlled, and she seems looser. It's hard to say whether that's just a tactic. It probably is, but she obviously realizes that something needs to change. So that's happening, and we're still seeing huge crowds for Obama. And it really does seem that he's going to probably succeed in getting a lot of new and younger voters out here as well.
And you mentioned the word change. All the candidates seem to be using it after relative newcomers Obama and Huckabee won in Iowa. But for all the bounce out of Iowa, Barack Obama, we read, didn't do well in rural Iowa, losing to both Edwards and Clinton there. And the new Rasmussen poll conducted yesterday shows that while Clinton's national support is ebbing, a week ago she led Obama 42% to 23%. Today she still leads nationally at 36% to his 25%. So obviously they're not going to flag now.
No, that's true. And anyone who thinks that that a loss in New Hampshire would end the Clinton campaign is doesn't understand the dynamic here. You know, she's got a big national base. She's still the establishment candidate. That hasn't changed yet. That's likely to be the case through February 5th, which is the big national primary where more than 20 states vote, including the big ones, her home state of New York, California. That's going to be a big day, obviously, and Hillary Clinton will certainly be in it at least through then. Those national polls are very important to keep in mind at this point.
Well, and in that national poll, Mike Huckabee and John McCain are tied at 19% on the Republican side. It's a much closer race, though, with Romney, Giuliani, and Thompson all within striking distance. Michael Barone writes in U.S. News & World Report this week that, you know, Mike Huckabee, take away his Christianity, which was at the forefront of his campaign in Iowa, he's really a much more populist, liberal candidate than many of the Republicans. Is that something that people up there are picking up on, or is it too late for issues at this point?
Well, it is hard for issues to come through, although, I saw Huckabee just the other day here, and it was very interesting. I mean, there were some lines in Mike Huckabee's speech about corporations and the power that corporations have that reminded me of John Edwards' speeches. So that's where Huckabee's trying to get his traction here. He's got to build his base beyond evangelicals if he's to succeed. Mitt Romney's also talking about some of those themes as well.
Yeah, talking about change as well. Mitt Romney took, some would say, quite a pounding in Saturday night's debate, has lost ground to John McCain. In just a few seconds we have, how's he trying to make that up?
Well, there was another debate on Fox News. I don't think it got as wide a viewership last night, but with the Republican base, it certainly did. And Fox News and a lot of conservatives are talking about it today, where Mitt Romney really recovered in that debate. He got Mike Huckabee to talk about how he had raised some taxes in Arkansas, and that's where Mitt Romney's going to try to stake his ground, is that he's going to claim that he's the true conservative.
Peter Walston of the Los Angeles Times speaking to us from the campaign trail in Manchester, New Hampshire. Peter, thanks as always.
You're welcome, Robin.
Hey there, how are you today? Nice to see you. Hi, folks.
This past Saturday morning, the Tilton Diner just off I-93 in Tilton, New Hampshire, was packed as usual.
We have our all-you-can-eat breakfast buffet going on.
Okay.
It does include your drinks, juice, coffee, milk, soda, hot chocolate.
And often on the menu, a hearty helping of presidential candidates.
We've had Mitt Romney. We've had, John McCain. We've had John Edwards. And we meet a lot of people who come from other states, bring their children during primary season to watch it.
That's manager Cindy Bates. Back in the tiny kitchen of the Tilden, short order cooks like Mike flip pancakes and home fries and consider Tuesday's primary.
As you do your cooking here, who are you thinking about?
For the Democrats, I'm thinking probably more Hillary, and for the Republicans, probably McCain.
So you're an independent?
I'm an independent, yeah. I'm much more of a Democrat socially, but I'm a little concerned about how they're doing with taxes. McCain seems to be a little bit more fiscally conservative.
But the Republicans had watch over the hugest deficit.
That's true. That's another good point. One thing I'd like to see is the election season to be shortened. Way too much money is being spent.
Eileen, you're up.
Yeah, it just seems to get worse and worse. Sandy, please.
As one of the signs on the wall at the Tilden Diner says, the waitresses are strong, the coffee has attitude, and we would add, just about everyone has an opinion. And as you listen to some, you'll hear how still undecided and fiercely independent Granite Staters are. We'll start with Howard Devine and his wife, Julie.
I think I'm considering either Obama or Hillary. I'm still undecided.
What's going to help you decide? What do you need to hear?
I think that the next 4 years are going to be four hard years. Our, you know, housing market's down, and I'm just trying to look at it, who can help us best through those 4 years. He's on the total other side of the ticket.
So let's go over to the husband over here on the other side of the ticket. Who are you looking at?
I'm looking at Romney.
And nothing out of Iowa changes that?
I'm going to vote for Romney. No, I mean, I just see it as he knows how to run a business, and he'll tidy the ship.
Because he was head of not just Bain Capital, but turned around the Olympics.
He knows how to get the biggest bang for your buck and spend money the right way, and he's going to run a business, and that's what it is.
By the way, how do you do that as a married couple, have a Democrat and a Republican?
I'm normally a Republican. This time, I think I'm just relating more to the Democrats. But I do like Mitt Romney also. So, it's been really hard. And we just had this talk last night, and I was saying, I don't know which way I'm going. I'm listed as an independent, and I don't know which way I'm voting. And I kind of woke up this morning and said, okay, I'm going to go on the Democratic side. And
Hillary and Bill passed me yesterday on the highway.
What was that?
Hillary and Bill passed me on the highway yesterday.
What's that like to be here in New Hampshire? I mean, I said incoming when I came over to your table, but that's what I feel like. I'm part of an infestation. What's it feel like?
It doesn't happen very often. It's nice to get a little attention, but Iowa's now forgotten, and they're moving on. So,
we love it. I think it's great. Everyone's here. Everyone's talking about it. There's such a heartbeat of politics and knowledge, and there's so much happening. It's the best. It's the best.
Do you mind if I just ask you a couple questions while you have breakfast? Well, thank you so
Hillary.
Much. I'm sorry?
Hillary.
Is that just all you have to say?
That's the one I want.
And why? Why are you backing Hillary Clinton?
I think we could use a woman for a change.
I just like the way that Clinton did his job, and I like to see Hillary do the same.
If I could move over to this side of the table. Well, what about you? Who are you thinking about ahead of Tuesday?
Edwards.
Edwards, why?
I think he has a lot of good ideas. Healthcare. And he's even going to do stuff with oil, gas.
You meaning what? Oil, gas? You mean hitting big corporations?
Hit big corporations. Don't hit like middle class. Who wants to go spend $700-$800 filling up a gas, your oil tank? And this president, what about the reserves? And Edwards said that he would dip into the reserves. He'd help the middle class.
Yeah. What's your family name, by the way?
Clark.
Well, the Clarks, thank you very much. Incoming.
Hey,
what's your name, by the way, if you don't mind my asking?
Peter DeMarco.
Is there anything that happened in Iowa that's sort of affecting the way you're feeling about your vote on Tuesday?
No. This is in Iowa, they think differently than we do. There are a gazillion evangelical Christians here, so I think that's why McCain does so well here.
And are you a McCain supporter?
Yes. He tells the truth. He says what he feels, whether it's popular or not.
For instance, his campaign almost got derailed because of his push for immigration reform. He backed the surge and was criticized for that, and you're nodding yes.
Yeah, and I disagree with him on immigration reform, but you don't have to agree with someone on everything. And what I just like the feeling that the guy isn't telling me what I want to hear, but is telling me what his true position is, his character.
Do you mind if I ask him? It's kind of personal, but are you registered?
Yeah, I'm registered, but I'm registered as an independent.
Which is what the candidates are looking for. Do you feel that in New Hampshire, that there's more of you, more independents?
That's why we're here. I mean, that's why people like this state, you know?
And what about Mitt Romney? I mean, he's got that house on Winnipesaukee. He's one of you in that way. He lives here.
He's not really one of us. I don't dislike Romney. I dislike some of his campaign tactics. His religion doesn't bother us here. I guess he's more confrontational than collegial.
Well, the pundits are saying that independents like Peter will make a big difference tomorrow, and our very unscientific poll at the Tilton Diner would seem to concur. Pundits are also pointing to the youth vote. And as we were leaving, we met one young man, too young to vote this time, but old enough to have a strong opinion. Hello. How old are you?
I'm 9.
What do you got on here? Who's number 81?
Yep, Randy Moss.
Okay, you got Randy Moss, fabulous Patriot who made that incredible catch, made that big score. Mm-hmm. So what are you thinking about the candidates?
I want Barack Obama to win, and hopefully that Hillary Clinton doesn't win because I don't really like her.
Wait. Why don't you like Hillary Clinton?
I think about Bill Clinton, what happened with him, and then I think about Hillary Clinton, how they have a connection together.
Oh. What do you like about Barack Obama?
That he could be the first black president, and that would be pretty cool.
What else about Barack Obama appeals to you?
Get the soldiers back, cut taxes, and all that. Because we're running a little low because we don't have health insurance right now. We don't have that much, and I want the taxes to go down. Because there's a lot of things that can happen to you as a kid. Because I broke my arm when I was 3, and we had health insurance back then. So if I break my arm now, that means that I don't have cover.
So, Dad just walked over. Why is it that you don't have health insurance? Was it a job change?
In between jobs.
So, who were you leaning towards?
Leaning more towards John McCain. I like pretty much everything that he stands for. I'm a former military person myself, so just that part of it alone.
How do the Republicans appeal to you on health insurance?
Well, as I listen to them, I don't think there's one person that can change all that. I know they all are saying that they all want health insurance for everybody. Is it feasible? I really don't think so.
Mitt Romney made it mandatory down in, you know, south of Massachusetts.
Yeah, but on a national level, I don't know that it could really happen.
Hey, what's the name of the family here? Who are we talking to?
My name's Jake, that's Alec, and that's Mackenzie.
And that's Daddy.
and your family name?
Snow.
Thank you, the Snows. Thanks very much. Enjoy your breakfast.
Sounds from the Tilden Diner in Tilden, New Hampshire this past weekend. How about that 9-year-old? Well, when we come back, we're going to head to the Canterbury Country Store, where residents post their mail and air their opinions, pro and con, on Hillary, as it turns out. But they have the same independent streak and often bedrock party opinions as well, we'll hear. Later today, Indiana requires voters to have a government-issued ID card. Supporters say it'll cut down on voter fraud. Critics say it'll keep the poor and disenfranchised, largely Democrats, from voting. So this week, that debate goes to the Supreme Court. That's later. Back in a minute, here and now. Let's hear more of our audio snapshot of New Hampshire. This past weekend, we drove from the Tilden Diner south to the Canterbury Country Store in bucolic Canterbury, New Hampshire. Both post office and slightly upscale general store, it's been the crossroads of generations since before 1900. Manager Tony Halla ushered residents like the Batchelders to our microphone.
Where's Sue?
Batchelders.
Susan and Herb. Yep. So start with Susan. What are you thinking going into Tuesday? Have you made up your mind?
Yes. Romney.
Myself, I like McCain. I don't think the country's ready for Obama or Hillary yet.
Personally, I like Obama, and it depends on, and I mean, I will go vote for Obama depending on who he's running against in the finals. And
well, you're for Romney now, but you could go for Obama.
I'm for Romney in the primary, but I could vote for Obama in the national because I do like him.
Yeah, no, Bill, you have to be heard.
Wild Bill Kelso. So what do you want to know?
Well, we're wondering
what you're doing. What are you thinking here in Canterbury as you approach Tuesday? Do you have your mind made up? You still undecided?
Oh, yeah, my wife has. She was going to go down and see Hillary this morning. She's pretty much set on Hillary.
How about you?
Well, I think she's all right.
Your wife or Hillary?
Well, I see her up to Hackleberry's Apple Watch.
You've seen her. So what is it that appeals?
Well, you know, the only thing is everyone, you know, they think that she's fallen behind her husband and all that. But you want to remember, behind every good man is a good woman. And I think that Hillary would be all right. Oh, if you want to take a chance on life, vote in Obama.
And here is what really stood out for us at the Canterbury store. People here seem much more comfortable expressing criticism, maybe because they're not just passing through like a diner, but they live here. And the store is an LLC, a limited liability corporation. Residents own the building and seem to feel free to speak their mind.
I had my mind made up. I wasn't going to vote for that woman or that Isama guy there, the Obama.
Barack Obama.
Tonight. Oh,
another reflexive Republican.
And the Canterbury store reminds us that while there are more independent voters in New Hampshire, bedrock Republicans and Democrats still live here side by side and have developed a repartee to pull it off. Take Tony and her husband Joe. They run the business, and Tony describes them as reflexive Republicans who come in contact with people every day.
It surprised me that people were almost pleased at Hillary's coming in third in Iowa. When she came to the orchard here, people were just enthralled with her. I thought this whole town was wild for her.
Two people that came in the store this morning who are registered independents who said, I normally would vote for McCain, but I'm going to get a Democratic ballot so I can vote against Hillary.
You heard someone say that?
Two people this morning in this store.
What is a reflexive Republican? Your wife's saying that's what you are.
I have reflexes, that's all.
You're just reflexive.
Unlike Democrats, who are limp. I have reflexes.
Now, that's careful, I could walk off the job here.
That's Lori Carey, the cashier, a devoted Democrat. How does this work? You've got this reflexive Republican, as she said. And then there's you. She said, yes, you're the liberal. Yes. And well, you're at the cash register.
Well, see, the problem... What the difference is that I'm a parent of four children. When you have children, you suddenly become concerned with these important issues such as education, paying the heating bills, you know, health care. So, you know, we tally back and forth on these various issues.
Who are you thinking about?
In my lifetime, I'd like to live to see a woman become president.
Is this the woman, Hillary Clinton?
You see, Joe says not this time, but this is the first time we've had a viable female candidate. Right.
What do you think she needs to say to get other votes?
Well, I think we have not talked about the gender issue. People do not want to vote for a woman president. Why is it we're the only industrialized country that cannot vote for a woman president? I don't understand that. She has met every dignitary there is to meet. Who better to go out and be an emissary for the United States of America?
Your redneck boss over there was telling us this morning that people were coming in here, you know, and they were jubilant that Hillary hadn't done well in Iowa.
I mean, I don't understand why it is that people are thrilled when women lose. What is it in our culture that doesn't allow us to have a woman leader?
Her boss, Tony, the reflexive Republican, is unmoved. You know, how does it work that you have these,
rigid opinions?
I wasn't going to say that.
My folks were Republicans, and I didn't have the wit to deviate from that. And I have liked the Republicans for the most part. I'm fiscally conservative, and I try to be as rednecked as possible and rigid.
Is part of the character?
Well, yes, partly, yes. The rigidity and the inflexibility suits the Republicans more. I have a wonderful time with that. I'm not comfortable with these kind behaviors that Lori... I really, let's say if they say, Tony, bring some canned food for the homeless, might reply to get a laugh, why in the hell would I bring canned food for the homeless? I'm a Republican. I don't care about the homeless. You understand? So we...
But Tony does have one vulnerable spot in the delicate dance of politics that's done here. It's when she's asked about the current Republican administration.
Even I will say I'm ashamed. But I'm ashamed of a lot of things.
Are you ashamed of the last 8 years of the Bush administration?
For the most part, yeah. Everything is done for personal gain and for oil or for money or for power, and I understand all that. This has been an abuse of what you have going into the game. Yet that wouldn't make me change because I'm a rigid, reflexive Republican. Why would I change sides?
That's Tony Halla, the self-proclaimed rigid, reflexive Republican manager of the Canterbury Country Store in Canterbury, New Hampshire. We also spoke to several residents and cashier Lori Carey, the self-proclaimed liberal Democrat. A reminder that unlike the warring candidates, the rest of us have to live with each other. Well, tomorrow in Here and Now, we'll go back on the road in New Hampshire as all the candidates compete for the young vote that put Obama over the top in Iowa. We'll speak to some college students there in New Hampshire. That's tomorrow. And still ahead, the country's first election was over 200 years ago today. Just how different was it? Back after the news, Here and Now. This week, the Supreme Court will hear a case that could affect the 2008 presidential election. On Wednesday, the top court will hear arguments for and against Indiana's strictest in the country law requiring voters to show government-issued photo IDs at the polls. Lawmakers in 27 states have proposed similar laws. The state of Indiana argues that requiring IDs is reasonable to prevent voter fraud, an issue championed by Republicans in recent years. But voting rights advocates say requiring IDs will keep the elderly, minorities, the poor, people who tend to be Democrats from the polls. And by the way, there's little solid evidence of either complaint from either side. Well, joining us on the line is Lyle Denniston, who covers the Supreme Court for SCOTUSblog.com and Here and Now. And Lyle, what's the significance in your mind of this case?
This really is the first time since Bush versus Gore when the Supreme Court has faced an election law case that is so thoroughly saturated with partisan interests on one side or the other.
And let's be clear, we just mentioned that there's no solid evidence of either argument, so I just want to clarify, is there any proven case of someone fraudulently voting, or conversely, a case of someone claiming they were unable to vote because of Indiana's requirement of voter IDs?
Well, there doesn't seem to be any well-established fact that anyone in Indiana has ever tried to impersonate somebody else at the polls, and there's never been a prosecution for voter impersonation in that state, according to the arguments of those who are challenging the law. There is a minimum number of studies of the impact of voter ID laws, but some of those appear to be done by people who have partisan interests on one side or the other of it. The Marion County Election Board, which is the one in Indianapolis, the largest jurisdiction, did a study of the impact of this law after it went into effect, and they found 34 people, many of whom had been longtime voters, who did not have a photo ID, so they showed up at the polls, they cast a provisional ballot, and only 32 of them had that vote counted because they didn't follow up and show an ID later on as the law requires.
So right now this is a theoretical debate about the law itself. So what does the Indiana law say exactly? Walk us through, what does it require a voter who comes to vote at the polls to do?
On Election Day, Robin, when you show up to try to cast your vote, you must first show a government-issued photo ID. That usually means a driver's license or a identification card that has been issued by the Motor Vehicle Department.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have that, you are handed a statement that you must sign, and it requires you to give 9 different forms of personal information and swear that they are correct. If you do that, then you are handed a provisional ballot, which you then cast. But in order for the provisional ballot to be counted, you must show up 10 days after the election, either at the county clerk's office or at the election board, and then produce a photo ID, or as an alternative, you can then sign an affidavit saying that I'm too poor to be able to afford a photo ID, or I have a religious objection to having my photo taken. If you don't do either one of those two things, then your ballot that you've cast provisionally will not be counted.
And just for those who haven't voted yet, either because they're too young or haven't gotten around to it, let's just remind people who may be surprised that you don't normally have to show an ID when you vote. Actually, in my polling place, you just come in, say your name, and they check it off a list.
Yes, well, and, you know, those who are challenging this kind of law say that the systems that we've had in place for a long time, those systems, according to the challengers to these laws, have always worked to prevent voter impersonation, so there's no need to add this additional layer of burdens that have an impact on at least some voters.
Well, those who back the law, what are the grounds that they give?
Well, first of all, they try to tie it to the election reform movement that has gained some speed since the election controversy over Bush versus Gore in 2000. Supporters of the law say this is just another reform, part of a long-needed reform to try to make sure that voter fraud is eliminated or at least significantly reduced. They depend upon historic claims that voter fraud has always been there and that, in fact, it is growing.
They've also said, we've read, you have to have photo IDs for so many things today, flying, for instance. Why not have it for the most sacred American act of all, which is voting? What about people who oppose the law? You mentioned that one of the arguments is, look, everything else has worked so far. There have been no real problems. But what other arguments are there against the Indiana law requiring photo IDs?
Well, they're basically trying to make an argument that this constitutes disenfranchisement of some people. There are people who do not drive and therefore do not have a driver's license, and there are people who have not had an occasion to obtain a photo ID from someone else. Those are the very people who will be intimidated because this makes it appear that voting is a difficult proposition. And by the way, another argument that's made by those challenging is that without exception, where these kind of laws have been passed, these photo ID laws, they have been passed along party line votes in legislatures, and when they have been upheld by courts, the judges have essentially divided along party lines. So the challengers are saying this is nothing other than a partisan effort to suppress voters who are inclined to vote Democratic.
Well, how might the Supreme Court rule?
Well, my own inclination at this point, Robin, is to expect that the court is probably going to apply a fairly lenient constitutional standard and may well uphold the law. The court gave at least a hint of its attitude in a quick decision that they issued without full argument last term. That case involved an Arizona law that required people who show up at the polls to show that they were citizens, and the court upheld that. It's unclear whether or not that was a real telegraphing of where the court might stand after they examined this in full. But I would think that at the end of the day, there is probably, if not a predictable, a reasonable prospect that the court will apply a fairly loose standard and say there's not a demonstrated problem here, that this is any greater inconvenience than registering to vote, so we're going to uphold it.
Well, at that point, Lyle, might we then see some actual cases? You mentioned that there was research showing that people who had gone to vote without a voter ID and then didn't follow through, and so their votes essentially didn't count. Might we see some court cases come in an appeal?
Yes, I think what's going to happen, two things, Robin, if the court upholds this Indiana law. One is that the movement to pass such laws is going to spread, at least in Republican-controlled state legislatures. And two, we're going to have much more serious and penetrating studies of how those laws operate in practice. And then if some voter actually is discouraged, or some group of voters are actually discouraged in a particular election, they are then obviously going to bring a new lawsuit and show that they were injured by this system, and therefore their constitutional right to vote was indeed undermined.
Lyle Denniston. Lyle covers the Supreme Court for SCOTUSblog.com and Here and Now. And Lyle, thanks as always.
Oh, I'm glad to be with you, Robin.
And again, the Supreme Court is expected to take up the issue of voter IDs this Wednesday. We'll bring you any news. Still to come today, over the Rhine, you're listening to Here and Now. Well, while we debate who will be the 44th president, we thought we'd celebrate the first, because the first presidential election in U.S. history took place on this day in 1789. Americans voted for electors who a month later chose George Washington as the nation's first president. Joseph Ellis is professor of history at Mount Holyoke College. He's author of His Excellency George Washington, among other books, and he joins us now from Amherst, Massachusetts. And Professor, first of all, I'm sure you're home lighting some candles and celebrating. Thinking of this day.
You know, I didn't even know it until you told me.
Oh, we thought maybe you'd be having that same sort of Shazam, you know. But how different? I mean, obviously it was so profoundly different in the beginning, but tell us a little more about how different it was.
Well, it was about as different as it could be, Robin. There were no campaigns then. In the first election, there were no political parties. There was no prescribed procedure. Different states selected their electors in different ways. The Constitution did provide that every state would have the number of electors that totaled the representation in the House and the Senate. But Washington himself claimed not even to know he was a candidate. It was considered inappropriate to be too self-promoting. And in fact, someone who campaigned for office was regarded as being unqualified for the office because he was displaying his ambition too conspicuously.
Imagine that.
Yeah.
And we know that George Washington was, you know, at the peak of his popularity, had been a hero of the Revolution.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, was he completely unopposed?
There were about 30 people that ended up getting votes. Most of them were votes by particular states for their favorite, what we call favorite son.
Right.
But Washington got all 69 electoral votes. That was the most you could get. He's the only president in American history, and he did it twice, to win unanimously. And John Adams got 34 votes. You got to vote for two people. They didn't distinguish between president and vice president at that stage. That comes a little later. And so Adams, by coming in second, became vice president. In a sense, it was a kind of plebiscite on one's revolutionary credentials. And it's interesting that for us in New England that Adams was regarded next to Washington as the single most important patriot.
Hmm. And so Adams becomes vice president, serves two terms, but complained to his wife Abigail about that office. He wrote, "My country has in its wisdom contrived for me the most insignificant office that ever the invention of man contrived or his imagination conceived."
Yeah, he's the first of many people as vice president to talk about it as what he called splendid misery. And later on, they talk about the not worth a bucket full of spit.
Well, and this was, you know, before John Adams could have conceived of a Dick Cheney, who's obviously had more power in that office. But Joseph Ellis, how did people vote? Did they put a piece of paper somewhere? Was there a box? How did they do it?
Yeah, there was a box, and they put a piece of paper in. But again, every state had a different way of doing it. In some cases, the electors were chosen by a special convention. In other cases, by the state legislature. And one of the reasons that you delay the inauguration of the president until March is that they figured it was going to take several months to get all the votes counted and then brought back to the Congress to be officially counted and recognized there. And that didn't happen for Washington until April. And then they sent a secretary down to meet him and apprise him that he had won the election. And he essentially said because he won unanimously, he could not turn it down. Mm-hmm. He really didn't want to be president. Probably no man in American history did not want to be president more than George Washington.
And just finally, Professor, you know, today we have hundreds of millions raised by candidates, one candidate spending millions of his own money. How would the candidates then think about what's going on today?
They would think that the Republic had become corrupt. None of them would have run in this kind of context. None of the first five or six presidents of the United States would have submitted themselves to this kind of process.
Well, today they'd say they don't have a choice.
They don't have a choice. We've created this system in the late 20th century that everybody has to go along with, and at some point you have to wonder whether any person in his or her right mind would ever want to put themselves through this process.
Joseph Ellis, professor of history at Mount Holyoke College. His most recent book is American Creation, Triumphs and Tragedies at the Founding of the Republic. Professor Ellis, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Well, but they do put themselves through it, and tomorrow we're going to be right there with them. Don't forget, we'll be broadcasting from New Hampshire tomorrow for Here and Now. We'll have reporters in the field, pundits in the studio, and we're also going to be visiting a high-tech company. We spoke to them in 2004. How are they faring, and what are they thinking now going into this presidential election? That's all tomorrow. Back after a minute break, Here and Now. the Rhine is an historic neighborhood in Cincinnati, Ohio, filled with European-style buildings and towering churches. German builders and 19th-century residents who crossed over the Erie Canal to work in downtown Cincinnati named the neighborhood to evoke the river of the old country. Well, Over the Rhine is also the name of a husband and wife alternative pop duo. Their new CD, The Trumpet Child, evokes the underground cabarets and dusky blues that immigrants brought with them to America.
Are you feeling a little desperate? Get on your knees and confess it. Honey, please, don't second guess it. You're desperate for love.
And we're joined now by Linford Detweiler. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
And Karen Burquest. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And you are Over the Rhine. Which came first, the relationship or the band?
The band came first, actually. Oh. And then the relationship grew out of that precariously, but it did.
Well, you might as well. You're traveling together, you know.
That's
might
true.
As well. Well, you've been making music together now for 15 years, opened on tours for Bob Dylan and the Cowboy Junkies. Linford, how would you describe the sound?
It's a blend of American music. On The Trumpet Child, we intentionally wanted to reference a pre-rock and roll era of American music, sort of the golden age of songwriting, with that playful language and also strings and horns and the occasional clarinet blowing through the music.
Let's listen to a little more. Here's Trouble.
Looks may be sweet and subtle. I think it's trouble, honey. I think it's good. Trouble, make me a double, honey, I think it's good.
Karen, I want to ask you about your vocals on this. You said that in the past you played it a little safer, but I read a quote where you said now, you know, you're lost in it, drunk on it.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
I think I just finally feel like I can let go and accept that this is what I do for a living. And when you reach that point, I think you forget about your inhibitions and own it.
Well, and you, in your own right, have what we're told is a fanatical following. And I'm wondering, Linford, do you think that it's because this kind of retro music is hitting its stride? You know, were you ahead of the game? How would you characterize that? Are they catching up with you?
I think our listeners are devoted because we're not afraid to admit that we're broken and struggling as well.
Like to give us an example.
Well, for instance, the record before The Trumpet Child was called Drunkard's Prayer, and Karen and I made that record at home in our living room. We had sort of run out of gas as a married couple, and we decided to hunker down at home for a while and just work on the marriage and mm-hmm. put some creativity into that part of it. And so we documented that chapter in our relationship on this record, and people just really responded to it. And I don't know, we're blessed with deep listeners.
Mm-hmm. What would you call this chapter for you?
Karen calls this the Let's Throw a Party chapter. We kind of cornered the market on melancholy on some of the earlier releases, and we wanted to just celebrate. And I think melancholy is easier for a writer than joy. So we wanted to get some joy on the record, and that's tricky.
Well, we certainly hear the joy on the CD, but also the bourbon-soaked and seedy. There's one song that's a kind of an homage to the unpredictable Tom Waits. Let's listen to Don't Wait for Tom.
He's got the hands of a blind piano player. He's got a feel for the dark like a soothsayer. He takes a little bow and tips his fedora. Shouts like he's gonna save Sodom and Gomorrah. Working for the circus ex-railroad bum. Carnival barker for kingdom.com. Dusty old Gibson, opposable thumb. Bangs out the rhythm on a 50-gallon drum. Don't wait for Tom.
Linford, what are you saying about Tom Waits?
He embodies so much of vanishing America to me. The itinerant preacher, the saloon pianist.
The vaudeville drunk.
Yeah, the beat poet and all of that. And
it's a really cool poem that, you know, was inspired by one of his shows. We try to catch him live whenever we can, which is rare. So it kind of grew out of a couple of spontaneous moments and a cookie sheet.
A cookie sheet?
Yeah.
That's Karen banging on the cookie sheet in there.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned something else that he represents for you, and I just want to ask, because Karen just told me before we started here, when you said, you know, the vanishing America, the itinerant preacher, Do I understand your dad was that itinerant preacher?
Yeah, my dad was sort of a restless soul. He grew up in an Amish community, actually. No electricity, you know, no radio, no automobile, whatever. And so that was one of those interesting leaps that we made, you know, from Amish boy to songwriter opening for Bob Dylan one
yes.
generation later. So that stuff fascinates me, that sort of only in America stuff. But yeah, he was a minister for a while, mostly small towns. And, you know, we grew up around a lot of old hymns, a lot of old church music. I think you can hear some of that gospel influence from time to time.
Well, in fact, let's listen to it in the title track, The Trumpet Child.
The trumpet child will blow his horn, will blast the sky till it's reborn. With Gabriel's power and such most grace, he will surprise the human race. The trumpet he will use to blow is being fashioned out of fire. The mouthpiece is a glowing coal, the belly burst of wild desire. The trumpet.
Karen, this comes naturally to you as well, that sort of churchy sound.
Yeah, I was raised in various churches. We went through the Methodist Church and the Pentecostal Church, and I got a lot of confusion, but I got a lot of good music.
I was reading also that you had a question that stood out, maybe even for both of you, that you always heard about a world reborn with the sound of a trumpet. Tell me more about that, Linford.
Yeah, we noticed that a lot of old gospel music referenced the sound of a trumpet, you know, Gabriel's horn and something big going down. And I was fascinated by that as a boy, and as we started hearing these great horn players, people like Louis Armstrong, and we've just been wondering about the sound of that trumpet. Do people still believe it's real? Is it a metaphor of some kind? And I've been playfully asking, you know, what exactly is on God's iPod?
See, now that's a good question. Well, I just want to note a couple of things. You said that there's a fuller sound to your pieces now, and it's in response to Katrina?
Yeah, we did want horns and clarinets, and we did want some of those rhythms. I think a lot of musicians were a little confused and hurt by the way the response was handled. Obviously, it raises a lot of issues, but it raises a separate set of questions for musicians, for the birthplace of jazz and ragtime, and so much of this great American music to be sort of backburnered was kind of confusing for us, and we're real proud to be a small footnote on this great tradition of music that could have only happened in America. And so we just wanted some solidarity there. We wanted some of that rhythm and some of that moaning and whatever to show up.
That's Linford Detweiler. He and Karen Berquist are over the Rhine. Their new CD is The Trumpet Child. By the way, for videos of the band and more about their tour, you can go to our website here-now.org. But I want to thank you both for coming in and talking to us about it.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you so much.
I don't want to waste good wine if you won't stick around. So come on, lies in love. That may fill your cup.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young, and tomorrow we'll be covering the primary from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio. Incoming. Please join us then. Here and Now.